Greetings on this Sunday morning. My name is Mike LeBurkin. Our guest minister this morning is Ron Ferris. He is a valiant member of our church and loyally serves as a high school Sunday school teacher in our religious education school. Please join me in lighting the chalice. Together we say, in the light of truth and the warmth of love, we gather to seek, to find, and to share.
Let's pray. How strange and heavy that we are here, occupying these pews, this place, and this planet. Wild minds as the cosmos in process. We are the universe as dream. We are bound by its emptiness and lit by its energy. Lit so as to see there are ways of seeing. Ways of seeing that emptiness and that energy. Ways of seeing the sky above, the earth on which we stand, water, father, mother, child. We are the universe dreaming. Let it be a good dream. Amen. We've had some hiccups this morning, so let's attend to that and make that a part of our practice. And it didn't start for me just when I got here. I actually was getting dressed today, and I put on a suit, and it was not my suit. I have no idea how I got the suit, but it was out to here. And so if I get through this sermon without mistake, maybe we'll have turned the corner. Anyway, I think I'm developing a little ritual, and it is self-indulgent, I know, so I hope you don't mind. But I have been quite naturally and organically developing a little ritual or habit that I do when I step into the pulpit. You see, the pulpit is like a circuit between the congregation and the better angels of their nature. And that makes me the circuit breaker. And sometimes I worry that I might blow. Which brings me back to my ritual. And here it is. I feel like I've begun most of my sermons with a confession. Something about preaching makes me want to confess. And it's the same today. I am simply compelled to name my transgression with regards to this role. You see, as I sat down to write this sermon, put on my theological space suit, climbed into the ontological rocket chair, and hit the ignition switch, I realized that I had no idea where I was going. Quite simply, I had forgotten the topic and title that I'd given for this sermon some weeks ago. Now, in my defense, I did recall that whatever the topic I had given, I had made it intentionally broad, so as to be able to fit whichever shape the Spirit moved me to take. I remembered that it had something to do with metaphor. And fear not, it most definitely will have something to do with metaphor. So my legal team says I'm in the clear, even if we do take the long way around. And we will take the long way around. Because first, I want to talk a little bit about preaching. It's this compulsion to confession that's really got me going right now. And it goes way beyond the imprecision of my memory, right? I do it every time. There's more to my sense of inauthenticity than that, because it's not just today. This confessional thing happens all the time. I come up here and I offer my inadequacy right off the bat. Maybe I'm just beating you to the punch. Sort of the preacherly, is this dress making me look fat kind of thing. And maybe I am cowed by the immensity of your trust and curiosity in the face of the elusiveness of the Spirit. Maybe. I do think part of my compulsion to confession is some sort of backdoor approach to authority. I mean, the one thing that I am an authority on is that I am not an authority on anything. And so that is honest, or at least a pass at honesty. And so now you think I'm being honest. And it's through that honesty that you then, in spite of my disclaimer, might grant me authority. Or so I think it goes in my mind. At any rate, it's just rhetorical jujitsu. It's a neat kind of trick. And this doesn't make it bad or untrue. In fact, it is not only true, but necessary in order for me to allow myself to be up here at all. The confession is born only out of good intentions to clear the air so that you see me, or rather, the message clearly, so that I see you clearly, so that I see myself clearly, and so that I might pursue and communicate those things which I have been charged to pursue and communicate when accepting the invitation to fill this pulpit. To put it plainly, I come up here and speak to you of things we need to consider that I do not consider, of things we ought to do that I do not do, of facts that I present as obvious, if ingenious, but that I had never even heard of until the night before. It's just a role. Or more like a dream. I am like this, my own figment. And to step into this pulpit is to step into, to inhabit, my dream. And it is shocking to me because it produces in me a feeling of discord that borders on dishonesty. But the beauty is that it forces me to face it. My dream and my being are so divergent here, but inhabit by force of commitment the same space. And I wonder if there's a place in your own life where you feel similarly. At any rate, for me, sometimes the coincidence of divergence feels like atoms splitting. And the energy released from that explosion, it has a sound. And that sound has a shape in my mouth and in my notebook. That shape surrounds an idea rendered as everything is by metaphor. And it goes something like this. Religion is a fiction, and I am a charlatan. The word charlatan comes from the Italian word salare, which means to prattle. The more full-bodied rendering of the word connotes a person who is being accused of resorting to pseudoscience in order to swindle his victims. Well, I admit to not understanding half the science behind the science I report from this pulpit. Yet the very medium in which I ply my trade, the very context with which I work, the material of my profession, at its heart, defies evidence. It is as I said, a fiction. It is a dream. What fact can capture the religious event? What scientific method can empirically measure meaning? What proof can we touch that there is anything beyond machine here? What test is explicit enough to convince me of God or art? There is none. It is all fiction and figment. Experience ordered and recast in the storybook of memory. But then, who better to speak of it than a charlatan? Fiction and figment are most basic response to the knowledge that we are alive and that we will die is a fiction. God is a fiction. The Big Bang is a fiction. History is a fiction. Memory is a fiction. How we relate to one another is fiction. In fact, in nearly every way, the you that you know is a fiction. Reality, as we understand it and experience it, which does in fact stand as other than or in addition to or sometimes even in contrast with material chemical fact, reality as we understand it and experience it is a fiction. David J. Linden is a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins. He's written that our brain responds to only one particular slice of possible sensory space. Our brains then process this sensory stream to extract certain kinds of information, ignore other kinds of information, and then bind the whole thing together into an ongoing story that is understandable and useful, to which I might add, we hope. We hope it's useful. Because what is not at stake is whether or not it is story, or whether or not I am a charlatan, or religion is a fiction. That is not at stake at all. It may, I hope, have sounded shocking at first, but shock is a mere parlor trick, a rhetorical sleight of hand we charlatans use to advance the rubes from A to D, skipping B and C, because it's too boring. No, fiction is our reality. So fiction is therefore primary and of the highest esteem, not the other way around. It is because it addresses fundamental fictions via myth and its intersection with experience and logic that religion occupies the center square of the great game. And what is a charlatan, preacher, priest, or parishioner, if not a poet with both hands sunk deep into the ink of this central fiction? So while it may have sounded like I was wallowing in self-loathing by calling myself a charlatan, I was doing anything but. In fact, I was not only calling attention to myself, but then paying myself quite the compliment. And I called it confession. What a strange dream. And it is beautiful. Fiction is beautiful because it is truth unbound to evidence. That is why, for instance, the Bible, or say the Grapes of Wrath, are such beautiful works, precisely because they are not evidence. They are truth, not fact. It doesn't matter, not to me anyway. There was a King David, Jim Casey, Resurrection, or the Holy of Holies. They are as true to me as my own name. They are as true to me as my mother, true to me as my father, as true to me as water, as the sky above, and the earth on which we stand. They are all fictions. They are a dream, And as I mentioned before, I am also, and especially up here, a dream. In fact, I had a dream the other day that was similar to this and most peculiar. Have you ever had a dream where you were talking about a dream you had? It's a strange thing because you begin to lose track of what you thought was a dream and what you thought was not a dream. See, in this dream, I was preaching here. Or it looked like it was me preaching. It was in the third person, so to speak. So I could see what looked like me, dressed in this suit and tie. But even though I could see a person that looked just like me, the only reason that I knew it was a dream was because the person that looked like me was not in the pulpit. He was walking up here, away from the pulpit, which is something I would never do. It terrifies me. He was looking at his note cards, and in the dream, the preacher was confessing about his inadequacies and how he felt like an atom bomb when his dreams conflicted. He was barking about fiction being a first thing in primary. "It's like breathing," he said. And then he took off his coat, because he'd seen preachers and politicians take off their coat, and it seemed like a neat trick. So the preacher continued preaching, pacing, talking from note cards about dreams and how God is a dream, and he loosened his tie here because he knew the stakes were high if he was wrong on that one. The preacher then tried to explain that we are vulnerable in dreams, in ways that our culture discourages in waking life, and how that very discouragement winds up creating a nation of neurotics. Dreams, the preacher said, are a venue for healing. I then saw the preacher roll up his sleeves, and for a moment, I wondered if this was going to be one of those dreams where the preacher, who looked really remarkably like me, was going to wind up preaching in his underwear. "Don't worry," said the preacher. "It's not one of those dreams." But dreams are like that. They're strange. And in a dream, I could tell the preacher was nervous that maybe he wasn't getting through, maybe he wasn't communicating as clearly as he had hoped. Maybe he wasn't speaking to the body, to memory, to dreams themselves. And he did not know what to do, and he began to sweat. And then I saw the preacher stop preaching. He seemed to pray. He said, "I don't know that I'm getting through. What do I do?" And then a voice came from everywhere and nowhere, like in dreams, and the voice said,
"It's in the song."
Well, that didn't make any sense. But that's okay, because dreams often don't make sense until you're analyzing them, and I wasn't analyzing just yet. I mean, what the hell is a pulpit, really? Why can't I leave it? And then the voice came again and said,
"Truth is in the song."
The preacher seemed to get it, though, as he started to lead the congregation in a song, "Around," which they sung twice through, where this section started it, and then this section came in, and then finally these two sections of the third. And they all started to sing, "Row, row, row your boat." And they started it when the preacher said, one, two, and... Okay, that's okay, because in the dream they didn't get it the first time either. And the preacher went back to the section and with more energy said, one, two, and... Hopefully that was memorable and germinating. Look, dreams are not argument. In keeping with that, I have eschewed presenting much of an argument today. But instead, I've tried to craft into explicitness what is often implicit and ignored. Life is but a dream. The world is but a stage. And Stanislavski said, there are no small roles, only small players. And Reichertzer said, the universe is made of stories, not atoms. So let's split those stories and play our lives wholly. Wholly. Stories are dreams reined and harnessed. And we are surrounded by them. Daydreams, movies, books, advertisements, comics, history, music, dancing, sporting events, reports on science, memory, you, me, everything is rendered in symbols and metaphor. Our whole lives, our positions in a room, where we stand in a conversation. Who we are in conversation with, our context, colors, where we work and play and how, all mean something and reveal our needs. If we are brave enough to see them as dreams, dreams to be harnessed, the truth to be discovered. Now, to make some argument this morning, and to throw a bone out to the scientific minds out there, it is compelling that during REM sleep, it looks more or less, from a recording of brain activity, like the person is awake. And see here, it's not that dreams and reality are equivalent. I can fly in my dreams sometimes, and as of yet, I cannot fly in reality. But the meaning we take, the way we form ourselves, how we interact and achieve some kind of happiness, satisfaction, and quality of living, the poetics, the fictions are true in very similar ways. And so now we are in the deep end of metaphor. Having stripped reality of its pretense to not pretending, we are left with only metaphor. We are left in a world where meaning is relative, a world drowned in deep symbols. And we could breathe under that water. It is here where the speculative art of interpretation can help us live a life more full. It is in dreams where we are forced to confront aspects of ourselves we have buried or forgotten. It is in dreams where the genius of our inner artist is allowed to reign, and we are reminded, soothed, indulged, lifted, and exposed in ways we think are unavailable to us in waking life. But if, as I've offered, waking life is a dream, a fiction that can be deconstructed and opened up. Well, now things get interesting. I wonder what would happen if we practiced the art of dream interpretation and then applied that practice to our waking life. What would happen if, having become somewhat practiced at exploring the metaphors of dream, we turned that metaphorical exploration onto our waking lives? What institutions, activities, illnesses, and relationships that look so necessary as to be taken for granted suddenly become ripe for personal revelation? What are we really doing? And this is what is at stake. It's a highly, gloriously subjective mode of being. But it is a way of being that investigates the mode in which we already subconsciously, biochemically live. It is a move away from an oblivious life. Imagine what happens when you bring the subconscious under conscious scrutiny and appreciation, or vice versa. For we are, after all, myth makers. We construe our life and the lives of others as tragic or beautiful, and that construal is reality. It is the way the world works. But usually the myth-making is retrospective. What if we made a practice of making the myth in real time? What if we made a practice and found depth and meaning and richness that we may uncover and live into? How strange and heavy that we are occupying these pews, this place, and this planet. Wild minds as the cosmos in process, we are the universe as a dream. We are bound by its emptiness and lit by its energy, so as to see that there are ways of seeing that emptiness and that energy, ways of seeing the sky above, ways of seeing the earth on which we stand, and water, father, mother, child. We are the universe dreaming. For as the bard says, and as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Out of airy nothing, this is how we live. This is life as God's process, life as art. You are the poet, accidental or otherwise. The question is, what are you saying?
We extinguish this flame, but not our dreams. I invite you to read the words with me. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again.